Chapter 29. Instead of resuming his investigation of South's brain, which perhaps was not so interesting under the microscope as might have been expected from the importance of that organ in life, Fitzpiers reclined and ruminated on the interview. Grace's curious susceptibility to his presence, though it was as if the currents of her life were disturbed rather than attracted by him, added a special interest to her general charm. Fitzpiers was in a distinct degree scientific, being ready and zealous to interrogate all physical manifestations, but primarily he was an idealist. He believed that behind the imperfect lay the perfect, that rare things were to be discovered amid a bulk of commonplace, that results in a new and untried case might be different from those in other cases where the conditions had been precisely similar. Regarding his own personality as one of unbounded possibilities, because it was his own notwithstanding that the factors of his life had worked out a sorry product for thousands, he saw nothing but what was regular in his discovery at Hintock of an altogether exceptional being of the other sex, who for nobody else would have had any existence. One habit of Fitzpiers, commoner in dreamers of more advanced age than in men of his years, was that of talking to himself. He paced round his room with a selective tread upon the more prominent blooms of the carpet, and murmured, "This phenomenal girl will be the light of my life while I am at Hintock, and the special beauty of the situation is that our attitude and relations to each other will be purely spiritual. Socially we can never be intimate. Anything like matrimonial intentions towards her, charming as she is, would be absurd. They would spoil the ethereal character of my regard. And, indeed, I have other aims on the practical side of my life." Fitzpiers bestowed a regulation thought on the advantageous marriage he was bound to make with a woman of family as good as his own, and of purse much longer. But as an object of contemplation for the present, as objective spirit, rather than corporeal presence, Grace Melberry would serve to keep his soul alive, and to relieve the monotony of his days. His first notion acquired from the mere sight of her without converse, that of an idle and vulgar flirtation with a timber merchant's pretty daughter, grated painfully upon him now that he had found what Grace intrinsically was. Personal intercourse with such as she could take no lower form than intellectual communion, and mutual explorations of the world of thought. Since he could not call at her father's, having no practical views, cursory encounters in the lane, in the wood, coming and going to and from church, or in passing her dwelling, were what the acquaintance would have to feed on. Such anticipated glimpses of her now and then realized themselves in the event. Rencounters of not more than a minute's duration, frequently repeated, will build up mutual interest, even an intimacy, in a lonely place. Theirs grew as imperceptibly as the tree twigs budded. There never was a particular moment at which it could be said they became friends. Yet a delicate understanding now existed between two who in the winter had been strangers. Spring weather came on rather suddenly, the unsealing of buds that had long been swollen accomplishing itself in the space of one warm night. The rush of sap in the veins of the trees could almost be heard. The flowers of late April took up a position unseen and looked as if they had been blooming a long while, though there had been no trace of them the day before yesterday. Birds began not to mind getting wet. Indoor people said they had heard the nightingale, to which outdoor people replied contemptuously that they had heard him a fortnight before. The young doctor's practice being scarcely so large as a London surgeon's, he frequently walked in the wood. Indeed, such practice as he had he did not follow up with the assiduity that would have been necessary for developing it to exceptional proportions. One day, book in hand, he walked in a part of the wood where the trees were mainly oaks. It was a calm afternoon, and there was everywhere around that sign of great undertakings on the part of vegetable nature which is apt to fill reflective human beings who are not undertaking much themselves with a sudden uneasiness at the contrast. He heard in the distance a curious sound, something like the quack of a duck, which, though it was common enough here about this time, was not common to him. Looking through the trees, Fitzpiers soon perceived the origin of the noise. The barking season had just commenced, and what he had heard was the tear of the ripping tool as it plowed its way along the sticky parting between the trunk and the rind. Melberry did a large business in bark, and as he was Grace's father, and possibly might be found on the spot, Fitzpiers was attracted to the scene even more than he might have been by its intrinsic interest. When he got nearer, he recognized among the workmen the two Timothys, and Robert Creedle, who probably had been sent by Winterburn. Marty South also assisted. Each tree doomed to this flaying process was first attacked by Creedle. With a small billhook, he carefully freed the collar of the tree from twigs and patches of moss which encrusted it to a height of a foot or two above the ground, an operation comparable to the idle toilet of the executioner's victim. After this, it was barked in its erect position to a point as high as a man could reach. If a fine product of vegetable nature could ever be said to look ridiculous, it was the case now, when the oak stood naked-legged, and as if ashamed, till the axe man came, and cut a ring round it, and the two Timothys finished the work with the crosscut saw. As soon as it had fallen, the barkers attacked it like locusts, and in a short time not a particle of rind was left on the trunk and larger limbs. Marty South was an adept at peeling the upper parts, and there she stood enkitched amid the mass of twigs and buds like a great bird, running her tool into the smallest branches, beyond the farthest points to which the skill and patience of the men enabled them to proceed, branches which, in their lifetime, had swayed high above the bulk of the wood, and caught the latest and earliest rays of the sun and moon, while the lower part of the forest was still in darkness. "You seem to have a better instrument than they, Marty," said Fitzpiers. "No, sir," she said, holding up the tool, a horse's leg bone fitted into a handle, and filed to an edge, "'tis only that they've less patience with the twigs, because their time is worth more than mine." A little shed had been constructed on the spot, of thatched hurdles and boughs, and in front of it was a fire, over which a kettle sung. Fitzpiers sat down inside the shelter, and went on with his reading, except when he looked up to observe the scene and the actors. The thought that he might settle here, and become welded in with this sylvan life by marrying Grace Melberry crossed his mind for a moment. Why should he go farther into the world than where he was? The secret of quiet happiness lay in limiting the ideas and aspirations. These men's thoughts were conterminous with the margin of the Hintock woodlands, and why should not his be likewise limited, a small practice among the people around him being the bound of his desires? Presently Marty South discontinued her operations upon the quivering boughs, came out from the reclining oak, and prepared tea. When it was ready, the men were called, and Fitzpiers, being in a mood to join, sat down with them. The latent reason of his lingering here so long revealed itself, when the faint creaking of the joints of a vehicle became audible, and one of the men said, "Here's he." Turning their heads, they saw Melberry's gig approaching, the wheels muffled by the yielding moss. The timber merchant was on foot leading the horse, looking back at every few steps to caution his daughter, who kept her seat, wearing how to duck her head so as to avoid the overhanging branches. They stopped at the spot where the bark ripping had been temporarily suspended. Melberry cursorily examined the heaps of bark, and drawing near to where the workmen were sitting down, accepted their shouted invitation to have a dish of tea, for which purpose he hitched the horse to a bough. Grace declined to take any of their beverage, and remained in her place in the vehicle, looking dreamily at the sunlight that came in thin threads through the hollies with which the oaks were interspersed. When Melberry stepped up close to the shelter, he for the first time perceived that the doctor was present, and warmly appreciated Fitzpiers' invitation to sit down on the log beside him. "Bless my heart, who would have thought of finding you here," he said, obviously much pleased at the circumstance. Wonder now if my daughter knows you are so nigh at hand. I don't expect she do. He looked out towards the gig wherein Grace sat, her face still turned in the opposite direction. He doesn't see us. Well, never mind. Let her be. Grace was indeed quite unconscious of Fitzpierre's propinquity. She was thinking of something which had little connection with the scene before her, thinking of her friend, lost as soon as found, Mrs. Charmond, of her capricious conduct, and of the contrasting scenes she was possibly enjoying at that very moment in other climes, to which Grace herself had hoped to be introduced by her friend's means. She wondered if this patronizing lady would return to Hintock during the summer, and whether the acquaintance which had been nipped on the last occasion of her residence there would develop on the next. Melberry told ancient timber stories as he sat, relating them directly to Fitzpierce, and obliquely to the men, who had heard them often before. Marty, who poured out tea, was just saying, "I think I'll take out a cup to Miss Grace," when they heard a clashing of the gig harness, and turning round, Melberry saw that the horse had become restless, and was jerking about the vehicle in a way which alarmed its occupant, though she refrained from screaming. Melberry jumped up immediately, but not more quickly than Fitzpierce. And while her father ran to the horse's head, and speedily began to control him, Fitzpierce was alongside the gig assisting Grace to descend. Her surprise at his appearance was so great that, far from making a calm and independent descent, she was very nearly lifted down in his arms. He relinquished her when she touched ground, and hoped she was not frightened. "Oh no, not much," she managed to say. Here was no danger, unless he had run under the trees, where the boughs are low enough to hit my head. Which was by no means an impossibility, and justifies any amount of alarm. He referred to what he thought he saw written in her face, and she could not tell him that this had little to do with the horse, but much with himself. His contiguity had, in fact, the same effect upon her as on those former occasions when he had come closer to her than usual, that of producing in her an unaccountable tendency to tearfulness. Melberry soon put the horse to rights, and seeing that Grace was safe, turned again to the workpeople. His daughter's nervous distress had passed off in a few moments, and she said quite gaily to Fitzpierce as she walked with him towards the group, "There's destiny in it, you see. I was doomed to join in your picnic, although I did not intend to do so." Marty prepared her a comfortable place, and she sat down in the circle, and listened to Fitzpierce, while he drew from her father and the Bark Ripper sundry narratives of their fathers, their grandfathers, and their own adventures in these woods, of the mysterious sights they had seen, only to be accounted for by supernatural agency, of white witches and black witches, and the standard story of the spirits of the two brothers who had fought and fallen, and had haunted Hintock House till they were exorcised by the priest, and compelled to retreat to a swamp in this very wood, whence they were returning to their old quarters at the rate of a cock's stride every New Year's Day, old style, hence the local saying, "On New Year's Tide, a cock's stride." It was a pleasant time. The smoke from the little fire of peeled sticks rose between the sitters and the sunlight, and behind its blue veil stretched the naked arms of the prostrate trees. The smell of the uncovered sap mingled with the smell of the burning wood, and the sticky inner surface of the scattered bark glistened as it revealed its pale matter hues to the eye. Melberry was so highly satisfied at having Fitzpierce as a sort of guest, that he would have sat on for any length of time, but Grace, on whom Fitzpierce's eyes only too frequently alighted, seemed to think it incumbent upon her to make a show of going, and her father thereupon accompanied her to the vehicle. As the doctor had helped her out of it, he appeared to think that he had excellent reasons for helping her in, and performed the attention lingeringly enough. "What were you almost in tears about just now?" he asked, softly. "I don't know," she said. And the words were strictly true. Melberry mounted on the other side, and they drove on out of the grove, their wheels silently crushing delicate patterned mosses, hyacinths, primroses, lords and ladies, and other strange and ordinary plants, and cracking up little sticks that lay across the track. Their way homeward ran along the crest of a lofty hill, whence on the right they beheld a white valley, differing both in feature and atmosphere from that of the Hintock precincts. It was the cider country, which met the woodland district on the axis of this hill. Over the vale the air was blue as sapphire, such a blue as outside, that Apple Valley was never seen. Under the blue the orchards were in a blaze of bloom, some of the richly flowered trees running almost up to where they drove along. Over a gate which opened down the incline a man leaned on his arms, regarding this fair promise so intently, that he did not observe their passing. "That was Giles," said Milberry, when they had gone by. "Was it? Poor Giles," said she. "All that bluth means heavy autumn work for him and his hands. If no blight happens before the setting, the apple yield will be such as we have not had for years." Meanwhile, in the wood they had come from, the men had sat on so long that they were indisposed to begin work again that evening. They were paid by the ton, and their time for labor was as they chose. They placed the last gatherings of bark in rows for the cures, which led them farther and farther away from the shed, and thus they gradually withdrew as the sun went down. Fitzpiers lingered yet. He had opened his book again, though he could hardly see a word in it, and sat before the dying fire, scarcely knowing of the men's departure. He dreamed and mused till his consciousness seemed to occupy the whole space of the woodland around, so little was there of jarring cider sound to hinder perfect unity with the sentiment of the place. The idea returned upon him of sacrificing all practical aims, to live in calm contentment here, and instead of going on elaborating new conceptions with infinite pains, to accept quiet domesticity according to oldest and homeliest notions. These reflections detained him till the wood was embrowned with the coming night, and the shy little bird of this dusky time had begun to pour out all the intensity of his eloquence from a bush not very far off. Fitzpiers' eyes commanded as much of the ground in front as was open. Entering upon this, he saw a figure, whose direction of movement was towards the spot where he sat. The surgeon was quite shrouded from observation by the recessed shadow of the hut, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.